Accession number 29537, Mr. Albert Arndt, Reel 9. Now, as things went on, you know, you went on lots of these patrols, and things got more difficult, you know, as the months went by, you know.
Yes, yes.
Now, what do you remember of how it got worse, if you see what I mean?
Well, it was because of the all the new gadgets that the Allies had. For instance, there was that the radio directing finding Huff-Duff, I think it was called. They knew, you know, they knew if we were above water, and especially if we had to give a signal, however short, that was detected very quickly, and they knew that we were there, and they knew where we were. So within a very short time, something happened, whether it was by naval craft or by aircraft. So most of the time, of course, we had to be on the water, which limited, of course, our... First of all, if you are underwater, you can't see. You depend on just what you can hear through our listening device. And, of course, underwater, you are very slow as well. You know, you can't move about because you have to conserve your batteries.
Now, the other thing is something called a singing saw. What was that?
Oh, we had these acoustic torpedoes which are homing onto the propeller noise of a ship. And of course the escorts knew about that. And they used to tow a device behind them which through the movement through the water, you know, were activated and made a noise. We used to call it the singing saw. It sounded like a sort of a circular saw going off underwater, and you know that the sound in the water is much better than in the air. And any torpedo aimed, for instance, at a destroyer, escorting destroyer, should be deflected onto this sound device. Whether it worked or not, I can't really tell.
Do you know what the British called it?
There is a name, but I can't. Yeah, right. I'll try.
I can't think what it is at the moment. We'll sort that out.
Mm.
Now, what else is getting more difficult? There's something here about the tactics of the aeroplanes, about you changing their radar.
Oh yes. Well, when we were above water, which was usually during the night time anyway, the reason for that was that we had to charge the batteries, and of course we had our own radar, Metox it was called, I think. It was more by sound than by sight, and you could hear if you were detected, for instance, by an aeroplane. And in the beginning, the nearer the aeroplane, the enemy aeroplane came towards you, the stronger the sound became. And that came a time when it was a certain strength, then you, of course, you had to dive, you had to crash dive. But what we noticed, that the radio or the operator in the aircraft was very clever, and as they came nearer towards us, I mean, they knew we were there and they knew where we were, they turned the strength of their sound slightly down, so we more or less heard always the same sound. So that was a confusion, wasn't it? And suddenly, I remember once an aeroplane, and it was sighted suddenly, and the captain even said, "Oh, I thought I had a tear in my eye," and that was an aeroplane. So we had to crash dive, and it was the usual few depth charges. I think they usually carried six. It was either a Wellington or quite often a Sunderland, and they always had sort of six depth charges.
What was it like being bombed or depth charged, you know?
Well, not very nice. Not very nice.
You just crash dive, I presume.
Yeah.
As soon as you saw it.
Yeah, we had a crash dive, yes.
There's something here we haven't done, which is that you used to wear red goggles to get your eyes used to the darkness before you went on the
Well, that is just, it's the same as it is now, I think. You know, when you are down in the submarine, you have, obviously, you have the lights on, and your eyes are used to that light. So if you should suddenly come from that light up into the darkness, it takes a good while before your eyes and your eyesight adjusted to the darkness. So before the order came to go up, we had to wear red goggles. And that somehow sort of, you know, quietened the eyes down away from the bright light. And you could see better when you were on top.
Another thing, your personal escape kit. Can you tell us about that? We haven't mentioned that either. You had an escape kit you had to carry with you, a bottle of oxygen and things.
Oh, we had the escape suit, which of course was, in comparison with nowadays, very, very primitive. It was sort of a device you put around your chest. You had a mouse piece, which you had to put in your mouth. You had a very strong spring clip, which you put on your nose. And in that device, I think it was called the Draeger lung. I think I mentioned it before. Draeger is the name who probably invented it or made it. And there was a small oxygen bottle fitted that when, you know, you breathe in through that Draeger lung, you breathe in and out. When the oxygen got rather thin, you could open the oxygen bottle to supplement new oxygen into the lung. I think it was roughly, if I remember correctly, it lasted, you could be underwater with this Draeger lung for about 20 to 30 minutes at the most.
Now, anything you remember from the later trips, or was it just the same, only harder?
It was just the same. It became harder, as you had to be most of the time underwater, in spite of having the snort or the snorkel. It became often very boring, you know, sort of day after day, the same routine, just listening, doing as little as possible to always conserve the air in the boat. And it was then mostly up to the radio operator or the one who was on the listening device to listen out for sounds, you know, propeller sounds, whatever.
Now, were there any other incidents you remember before your last trip? Just to pick up, tidy up, you know, anything else you remember before we go on to... Because your last trip was off Ireland, I think it was, northwest
the last
Ireland.
Trip, I
anything
think...
before that? Anything you can think of we missed out? You seem to have been on operations a long time.
Well, personally, I had five, if I remember correctly, action...
Sorties,
whatever, yes. Some lasted maybe a week or two, some lasted probably 2-3 weeks, just depending where they sent us. Yes, it was very... very monotonous, and you know, after a while, the food, the fresh food came to an end, and you had to live on the tinned stuff.
Now, tell me about your last trip, because you took some apples and lemons aboard, I think.
Oh, yes, well, especially we wireless operators, we had just that little bit more space. For instance, the stool we were sitting on in the radio room and also in the listening device room was like sort of like a piano stool, if you like, and there were books in there, especially the secret books. And we had always a little room to either stow away a few lemons or a few apples, which we sort of kept and sort of had one every day or a bit of every day, you know, until they run out. Especially lemons, because we couldn't brush our teeth very often, because you were limited with fresh water to a very small amount. The washing had to take place whenever we did wash, in sea water. And we had a special seawater soap, which helped a little, but wasn't, you know, I mean, after a week or 10 days or longer, you got was a little bit smelly and, you know, scratchy. Your beard grew because there was no shaving. And the stuff you were wearing, you couldn't change. You just had to wear it throughout, whatever. So it was not very comfortable.
Now, on your last trip, you got ill. Tell me about that.
Oh, the last trip, yes. I believe we left from Trondheim. That was the last trip. And we went into the North Channel, northwest of Ireland, and the North Channel, which is between Ireland and the Hebrides, I believe. Yes, I suddenly, that was in April 1945, our last sortie. I had a terrific pain in the lower abdomen, my stomach. And of course we had no doctor on board. We had one sort of trained medic or whatever it was called. Well, they diagnosed that I had inflamed appendicitis, appendix, inflamed appendix. Of course there was nothing they could do. They stopped me from eating. I could drink, and I was given sort of tablets. They were called dextroenergine. They were the special energine, and you know, to get energy. It was sugar and glucose and whatever. And I had to lay in my bunk, and I had ice packs on the right hand side of my stomach. That was supposed to be good. It kept the pain away and kept the, if I remember, it must have taken maybe 4 or 5 days and I got better.
So it
the pain went.
Was it appendicitis or not? It was, right?
It was. Yeah, the pain went. So I went back to my normal duties. And of course then, on, as you know, the 8th of May, the war came to an end.
How did you feel about that? I mean, were you pleased or you know?
Well, I didn't really. I think it didn't really sink in what was actually happening. Just to finish off that chapter with my illness, I heard later on, that the officers, especially the captain, they had discussed my situation. If it had not been got better, I mean, there was no way they could help me. You know, if you got a bad appendicitis, and it was actually later a perforated appendix, there was nobody there to help me. So they had made a decision that they wanted to put me in a rubber dinghy, go as near to the Irish coast as possible, you know, and watch the tides and sort of float me onto the beach, hoping that somebody would pick me up. That was sort of the best solution they could think of, because if the appendix would have been perforated, I probably would have died, because they couldn't help me. So fortunately, I got better. And later on, during May, when I was in a prisoner of war camp,
it went again. We'll come to that.
But we come to that.
Now, what about your orders to surrender? You'd presumably not be on... That was on the 8th of... It was on V-Day. You were ordered to surrender by Dönitz. Do you remember what the reactions were? Because you were told not to damage the submarine, all this.
Yes.
What do you remember?
I remember one incident. We sank one ship somewhere in the North Channel.
When was that?
That was during the middle or towards the end of April. I've written the name down, but I can't remember offhand.
What type of ship was it?
A freighter, sort of probably a tramp, I would say. And then, well, April came to an end, and I believe it was on the 8th of May.
8th of May, so yes, right.
8th of May, when we received a signal from our commander, D. doing it, right? Saying that the war, you know, came to an end, that there was surrender, non-conditional surrender. We were told that from now on, any message is received from our, from the our Admiralty, Dönitz, whatever, was open, was not in, was not keyed anymore. We were told to service. We were told to hoist a black flag. We were told not to sink or damage or something the boat. We were given a frequency to tune in with the Allied frequency and do whatever we were ordered to do. So that is what we did. We went up. I remember we took it in turns to come up to get a bit of fresh air and actually see the sun, which was quite nice. We received orders to stay where we are. We could not withdraw our torpedoes from the tubes because the sea was too rough. It could only have been done when you are submerged because it's quieter down in the water. So that message was sent that we still had 5 torpedoes in our tubes. I don't know how long it took when the first airplane came. I think I was told it was a Wellington bomber. And through signals and through exchange of orders, information, whatever, we were told exactly what to do. And then after a while, it probably was quite a few hours, we saw some Allied warships coming towards us. I don't know what they were, destroyer, corvettes or whatever. And a detachment of one of these ships came on board of our submarine, led by a British officer. And they conversed and talked to the captain, to the officers, and the official sort of surrender was agreed.
What and did the boarding party do? Do you remember?
There was a boarding party. I don't know how many. There were some in the bow. There were perhaps 2 or so in the diesel room. There was 1 or 2 in the control center. And one officer. I remember seeing these young lads coming in. They were just as young as we were. They looked perhaps a bit apprehensive. Perhaps even a bit scared, which is understandable. We just sat about and waited for orders. And eventually, we were ordered to make for Scotland, Loch Erible, which is right on top, by the north of Scotland. And as far as I can remember, it must have been round about the 10th of May when we came into Loch Erible. And our submarine, U-293...
Can I just ask you, yep, what you felt about this, the whole process? I mean, I know you don't remember too much, but yeah. I mean, how did you feel about the surrender and everything else?
Well, it was something you couldn't sort of take in very quickly because, you know, for months and months on end, you went through the same routine. Everything was the same. The war was on. It was dangerous. You did this, that, and the other. And it gradually sort of sank in that there was no more fighting. I think probably the older ones, I would say definitely the officers, probably were glad that it was over. Because basically everyone knew that we lost the war, as it were, and it was finished. For us younger ones, perhaps by the time you took it in, that the war was over, there was no more fighting, there was no more danger, you gradually absorb that. And then your thoughts went, what will happen now? You know, what happened to us? Where will we go? And so forth. So we did what we were told.
Now, what happened at Loch Erebol?
Loch Erebol.
That's where you went first. Do you know any of the ships who were with you? I presume you don't, do you?
Yes, I know it because, firstly, according to the information from the Imperial War Museum, because I saw one or two films when the submarines came into Loch Erebol, we were one of the first 8 submarines to come into the loch. And the film I actually saw on the reel, of which I bought a copy from you, you actually could see our boat coming in Loch Erebol, with the captain on top and the first officer, and some of the crew already ready with their lines and fenders and whatever. And that was quite an emotional moment when I saw that film after some 61 years. Yeah, we made fast. We were actually next to one of our sister submarines. I think it was 823 or something, whatever. And we must have been there maybe for a day, perhaps two. And then all the submarines were ordered to steam into Loch Elsh, which is opposite, what is the island called? Skye, wasn't it? Opposite Skye. And there were quite a number of submarines in there. And we were taken off the submarine. Most of us were taken off the submarine. Our crew was all assembled on the foredeck. The captain just explained what will happen. We all said goodbye, and we were taken onto a large ship, a British Allied ship. We were able to take our personal things, you know, our kit bag, and a skeleton crew had to stay on the submarine. Then the submarine was disarmed, the torpedoes were made safe, the ammunition was taken out. I believe most of that stuff was dumped overboard. The barrels of the anti-aircraft guns were sort of, you know, dismantled, and according to that film, they were just thrown into the drink, you see. We stayed on this ship.
Now that's the Athenia from your notes.
Sorry?
The Athenia. Athenia, that's the name in your memoirs. That you say it was the SS
Athenia.
Oh,
was it? All right, yes, well, there you are.
Now, what were conditions like on board that ship?
There must have been quite a number of us on board of that ship. We were taken down... right down deep in the bowels of that ship, when there was a big hold with, you know what a hold of a ship is when loads are put in. There was all metal, all iron, steel around you. We slept on the floor. We were given food. We were given drinks. We were taken under guard, sort of, two or three of us, to the washroom, to the toilets. You know, I mean, you had to wash. We were actually glad to have a wash and a shave. When you went to the toilet, there were no doors on, so you had to do your business, as it were. And the guard stood, while he actually turned round, looked away from us. So I cannot remember how many days we actually stayed.
So you were heavily under guard then? I mean,
they all had their little, what we called them, pea shooter, you know, their revolvers on sort of a white cord around the neck. Yeah, it was all under guard. I think we were allowed to have one razor blade. We had to sort of take the others, we had to hand them in for whatever reason. Safety, I expect. So we stayed on there. I remember it must have been more than a day, probably two, probably 3 days. We were allowed to go on deck at certain times, you know, on the fresh air. And we used to sing up there. We used to sing these old sea shanties. You know, singing in the Navy, especially in the German Navy, was one of these things we sang together. That was quite nice. I mean, we could see the Loch, we could see the Isle of Skye in the background, which at the time I didn't know what it was. And eventually, we were then taken to the nearest railway station, wherever that was, Loch Elch. And we were taken under guard to London, to Campden Park. You know, Campden Park was the race course. And that was made into a large prisoner of war camp, temporarily. We were there taken under guard, and I remember it's obviously quite a long journey from up there.
What was the train journey like?
It was quite pleasant. We were actually surprised to sit on upholstered seats, which sort of wasn't really, we were not used to that at all. And the guards, they seemed to be Scottish. They wore their khaki uniform and they had their little berets on with a bubble on top. We presumed that they were Scottish. So we tried to... We were allowed to converse with them in the little English we were able to master. They were very keen to buy payment cigarettes, of course, to buy souvenirs, special any medals we had, and any sort of, you know, mementos. They were very keen to get off us, but I didn't sell anything. we were given food, we were given drink. It was not unpleasant. When we got to Campden Park, I remember the atmosphere was not very nice.
And why was that?
Because those who were put in charge of us, who gave orders to us, telling us what to do, when to do, how to do, they were shouting at us, they were calling us not very nice names. I can't remember actually what it was. It was an atmosphere.
Now, were they British or what?
That we didn't really know. There was a rumour going round, you know, after a while, that these people were either Poles or Czechs who were fighting, you know, with the Allied troops. They were not, definitely not very nice. We were registered. We had to form queues according to...
What was the procedure? I mean, how formal was it? You know, the documentation of it.
Well, we had to take our kid bags, you know, like sailors, they got their big bag. We were first registered, you know, name, rank, details and whatever. Our pay books were taken away. Any other sort of personal things which they thought they wanted to look at was taken away. I had a photo album that was taken away. We were then registered. We were given a number. When that was all done, we were deloused. We thought that was rather a little bit degrading because none of us had lice or something.
We were... How did they delouse you? Was it with DDT powder or with showers?
Yeah, that usually powder, you know, in your chest, in your trousers and up your sleeve and whatever. then we were taken into different groups outside this compound where there were tents. We were given tents. I think there must have been 10 or 12 to a tent. I remember one thing, because I was rather a bit disappointed that my photo album was taken away. So I plucked up the courage and talked to one of our guards. They were actually British, they were English soldiers. I explained what it was about, and he kindly went to an officer, explained, and that officer came, talked to me, and I explained again to him. And then the officers went into the whatever it was, and he came back with my photo album and handed it back to me. And I thought that was rather nice.
So, and you've still got that today?
I've still got the photos, yes. Yes, not the album. I've got the photos, yes.
Now, you weren't there long, were you?
No, we were not long there. No, I've really got not much memory.
Says to June.
It must be sort of towards the end of May or something.
Says June. Says 14th.
Probably,
of June.
Yes.
That, so it was
that
a
sounds,
month.
That sounds right, yes. We were taken again to the station, a station. I can't remember which one it was. We were sorted out, and I and many others. It was then a mix. It wasn't just Navy. It was Navy, Army, and Air Force personnel, up to non-commissioned officers. We were taken up to a camp in Yorkshire, North Yorkshire, a camp near Hanmanby, was a little village which is not far from Driffield.
So the village was Manby?
Hanmanby.
Oh right, Hanmanby.
Hanmanby. Well, we were marched in, there was a short march, maybe half an hour march, into that camp. It was right in the middle of nowhere. There was an old, very large Nissen hut, which was the cookhouse and sort of the dining room, as it were. We were, the first night, we had to sleep on the grass. I remember I had a big stone as my pillowcase. And it was cold when I woke up in the morning, because May is not a very warm month. And I was woken up by somebody giving me a hot cup of that lovely British Army tea, which comes from a tin. It's all mixed, isn't it? It's tea and milk powder and sugar mixed, and you just pour boiling water on it. And that was absolutely beautiful. We were given tents, and we had to build up our own tents, and we were given straw to put in the tents and blankets to cover ourselves up. And outside the POW compound, there was a small compound where the British, where the doctor, there was a doctor there, there was an officer and the you know, the soldiers who watched over us, the guards, if you like.